Hey guys, this is Kevin Estello of Fieldcraft Survival. I'm your host for this ad space right before the podcast. And I just want to take a couple minutes of your time to give thanks to Hoist. And Hoist is one of those hydration drinks that, you know, if you come here to North Carolina and you go into our fridge, you know, we'll often tell you like, hey, try this drink. It's from Hoist. Hey, we've got spares for the student, whatnot. People love Hoist and you can find it in all the supermarkets around here. It's one of those drinks that, you know, I get it. Water is good for you, but sometimes water can just be boring. And if it's boring, you're not going to drink it, or there's a chance that you're not going to drink it. So if you have something with some flavor, then guess what? You're probably going to consume it. You're probably going to stay more hydrated. And when you are in our training courses, whether it's in the high humidity of the summer or it's in the dry air of the winter out in Utah, listen, you got to stay hydrated. So Hoist is one of those companies that we've partnered with. And they take care of our students and they're going to take care of you. Now, all you got to do is use the coupon FIELDCRAFT10, FIELDCRAFT10, and you can get 10% off of your order. As I already mentioned, there are ready to drink bottles that you can find in supermarkets. You can find them here in our North Carolina office. One of the things that I like is the powdered drinks mix. And the reason for that is because if I'm going out into the backcountry and I'm using, you know, my water treatment method, whether that's, you know, chemical pills or I'm using a filter or whatever, well, it doesn't always get rid of the flavor and Hoist does a pretty good job of masking that. So I know the water is safe to drink. I just want it to be better tasting to drink. So again, guys, please check them out. I use it. A bunch of the folks here at Fieldcraft use it. My buddy, John, you know, who runs the Gray Farm. John is probably the biggest Hoist junkie I know. So check them out. Go to their website. Use the code FIELDCRAFT10. You'll get 10% off of your order. Also, just want to give a shout out to all the students who have come to our classes. Guys, it's been an exciting training year. We've run a lot of different classes all over. Jared, also known as Army Mace, has been teaching up in the Pacific Northwest. I've been up to SIG. I've been teaching all over out in Utah. A lot of sold out classes. I appreciate every one of you guys for coming out and training with me, training with my team, training with the good folks here at Fieldcraft. So shout out to all of you and hopefully you'll enjoy this podcast. So without further ado, let's get to it.
Hey guys, you know how important sponsors are to the podcast, not because they're just sponsors, but because they're partners of Fieldcraft Survival. Good people and good companies. No exception coming from firecracker.farm. You guys might have seen me using this on social media before we partnered with these guys. I loved it because I love spicy food. It's a push grinder that has hot salt and has three different peppers infused. It's got the good old Ghost Trinidad and Carolina Reaper peppers. So not for the weak or faint-hearted. I use it on all the food. You could take it camping. I've taken it overlanding. I've used it in the last mobility experience. If you go to firecracker.farm and use coupon code Fieldcraft, one word, Fieldcraft, one word, you can save 15% on your first order. Again, firecracker.farm, use Fieldcraft as a coupon code. Fieldcraft, one word, to save 15% on your next purchase. Thanks, guys.
This episode is brought to you by BioPro Plus. Why do our hormones suck as we get older? Our human growth hormone and its derivative of growth factors can reduce by 50% by age 35. And it doesn't matter how hard you train, how good you eat. If we don't have the proper hormones in our body, we're not going to get the results we want. BioPro Plus is the first of its kind non-synthetic alternative to prescription human growth hormone. All the benefits of synthetic HGH without any of the needles, side effects, or doctor's visits. Guys, that's the ad that I'm supposed to read, and it's the truth. But I've been on BioPro myself for a year and a half, and it has drastically changed my life, my fitness, and my health in general. I suffer from traumatic brain injury from years of blast overpressure, working with explosives, and I don't suffer from any of the side effects anymore. My fitness is better than it's ever been, and I'm going to be 45 next week. So head on over to bioproteintech.com. Click on the link, use code FIELDCRAFT for $30 off your first order. Don't take it from me, go try it yourself.
How's it, everyone? This is Nate with the Field Craft Survival Podcast. I get to be your host today, which is, I think, the first time I've ever done this. So bear with me as I...
I hosted one before you did. Oh, my God.
Yeah, dude. As I figure all this nonsense out. But I'm excited. I've got Greg Lappin with me today as our guest. Kind of a guest. I don't even know if that counts.
I'm your guest right now. You're the host.
Okay, is that how?
I'm a resident guest, even though I literally live
behind in the back
parking lot of Fieldcraft right now.
Cool. Greg is our new Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt and the head of our Jiu-Jitsu Academy. But he has probably one of the most extensive backgrounds out of any of us here at Fieldcraft. He's not just a pretty face with cauliflower ears.
Not so pretty anymore.
But this is going to do, dude, I'm excited to roll through all of this. Again, out of all of us here, which is, that's saying something, by the way. I get to work with some of the coolest people here at Fieldcraft, and like dude after dude, person after person, with all the extensive backgrounds, all the crazy people that we get to meet coming into contact, that is quite the feat, I think, to have as diversified as a background.
Now you're stuck with me.
So, you know? Dude, I'm excited to dig into this, man. This is going to be wild. Hey, so I think the most logical place to start is where are you from and what kind of a kid were you?
Yeah, so I was born in New York City, and very quickly my parents moved to the suburbs of New Jersey, like a lot of city people do. They have a kid, and then now they don't want to live in the city anymore. Grew up mostly in northern New Jersey, very rural New Jersey, like not Sopranos, Newark shit, you know, like real rural, outdoor kid, riding my BMX bike, hiking on the weekends. I grew up playing ice hockey, played ice hockey from the time I was like 4 years old till I was basically playing in an adult league as a teen. I saw adrenaline from day one. I was like, I'd rather be out with my Vietnam era e-tool digging fighting holes in the woods or riding my BMX and building awesome, sick, sweet jumps, dude, you know?
That doesn't sound like what the rest of your background is going to
lead to. Building sweet jumps, yeah. Yeah. But no, I was, I like being outdoors. I like doing kind of stuff that got my blood pumping, and that was, you know, riding my BMX off jumps and cliffs and rocks and shit and playing ice hockey. And that's kind of how I came up. I played a lot of army, you know, like every birthday or Christmas, what did I want? Like I wanted like the newest Vietnam era shit from the surplus store.
There's something about just Vietnam era stuff that reason, like that's, that if you're a kid like being raised, I don't know, maybe it's just our generation. Well, maybe it's different because if you're a kid nowadays, there's so much access to literally all the kids LARPing with airsoft are buying bump helmets.
And dude, they have a better kit than I do. And I did this for real.
Dude, you know? I had to spend $40 on a steel pot, like an old school steel pot from Vietnam at a surplus store in Flagstaff, Arizona, if I wanted kit.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you know, the devil was in the details. So like you had the old school like jungle boots with the green nylon and the black leather boots, right? And then like obviously old school woodland camis. If you're really high speed,
you
got the old tiger stripe.
Right. You know?
And then like the thing that set the nerd kids off from like the cool kids is if you got one of those short little customized boonie hats. Not the real issued ones, but the short ones that were like built overseas, right?
You had
the old LBE shit, you know? That's what I did. Yeah, as a kid.
So that's what you wanted to do, or that's what you did as a kid. What's actually interesting, so for your background, it almost feels like maybe a reverse order, if that makes sense, because you said you got to start in corporate security.
Yeah, so kind of, I guess, you know, right place, right time. I was never in the military. You know, a lot of people think that I was or assume that I was. I was never in the military. I wanted to go into the military. So I signed up for, at the time, and this is, we're talking 97, 98. Just got out of high school. And I wanted to go into the military. The only thing at that time was they called it the BUDS Motivator Program. So it was a motivator program working with reserve and active duty SEALs 1 weekend a month, getting young kids prepped. Now, there's tons of those programs for every branch of service, mentorship programs, if you will. And they were getting me ready so that I could dep in and go enlist in the Navy at the time. This was pre-war, went and saw a recruiter. Recruiter was brand new on recruiting duty, didn't know what he was doing, and put down that I have an allergy to foods, which I do. I have an allergy to freaking tree nuts, walnuts, pecans, almonds. I know it's the dumbest thing
ever. Greg does not do well with the nuts.
No, I don't. I hate the nuts.
They'll cause your mouth to swell up.
And yeah, exactly. I mean, it's bad. Nuts hit my lips and it's just all over. But yeah, so that was a wave. That was a disqualifier. It was considered an allergy to common foods is how they classified it. It was a disqualifier. And I got disqualified from military service. I applied for a waiver. Waiver went down to BUMED, Bureau of Medicine. They looked at the waiver and they permanently disqualified me.
What's so nuts about all of this?
But I'm bumped.
That's going to happen a lot. Mm-hmm. Is again, how often someone's story starts off with a recruiter.
Yeah.
And how often people either like don't seek in a second opinion or they go for a second opinion. Right. The hard part is like, once you start paperwork, now you're a person with paperwork. That's and right. it's a whole process.
At the time, I didn't have any mentor to guide me. Yeah. I didn't have anyone to tell me, look, when you go into the recruiter, they're going to ask you all these questions. Just say no to everything.
Yeah. And again, nowadays, again, what are you going to do? You're going to Google a recruiting station right. or there was one in high school
so
or
many,
whatever the case
there's
is.
There's so many programs to go that are going to help you nowadays, you know? And back then there was none of that. I mean, you know, you couldn't look up half the shit we find on YouTube now, you know, you know, your thing was, I read old Vietnam era books on, you know, SF and SEALs and force reconnaissance. And like, I have all these books still. And, so yeah, I got permanently disqualified out of military service. Excuse me. Right at about the same time, I started going to college. My parents really wanted me to go to college. My dad grew up dirt poor, like super poor. Never went to college, but worked his ass off and made it and like made a really nice living. But what he knew was if you want to be successful, you had to go to college.
Yeah.
Right. So my parents really pushed me to go to college. So while I was waiting to try and figure this all out and see if I could get in the military, yada, yada, I went to college. I was at Rutgers University, New Jersey. And I met a buddy of mine who ended up becoming a mentor, about 10 years older than me, just got out of special operations, was going back to finish his degree. We became buddies. He took me under his wing. We started PTing, swimming, working out together. He was teaching me land nav. We'd go shooting yada, all the stuff that he was like, we're going to get you ready. We're going to figure out a way to get you in. And boom, September 11th happens. Planes crash into the buildings. And he got tasked to set up a personal security detail and security team for some Deutsche Bank buildings and executives. And we had built a really strong relationship. We had been together for probably the last year and a half, you know, PTing, working, shooting, et cetera, et cetera. And he asked me if I want to come work for him. And I was literally like, what the fuck do I know, dude? I'm a young college kid. What the fuck do I know about this? And he's like, dude, you know, you've got the mindset, you've got the skill set, and I will teach you the job. Right.
Exactly. And, you know, what you need is the mindset and the skill set.
Right.
You know, I mean, and
I'll teach you the job.
I can work with the rest.
Yeah. This isn't, you don't need to be Jason Bourne to do the shit we were doing. We're standing half the time, we're standing watching a fucking door, you know?
But like it helps.
But it helps. I had good hair. That's all that mattered. Right.
Yeah.
So I worked on a security detail for Deutsche Bank. For a few years, actually, literally we were down there like 9 days after the towers went down till I left in 2003. So, you know, a couple years I was there working and I got to meet all these soft dudes.
What was it like 9 days after the towers went down?
I was disgusted. Dude, I'll never, ever forget the smell coming home from working like a 48-hour, 72-hour shift down there because we worked these long shifts. We had a team room and we had like, you know, bunks and everything. And then I'd get home to my apartment and I'd take a shower and you'd rinse the death and dust and charred, burnt shit off of you. Like I'll never forget that smell. Yeah. It was gnarly. A lot of us, we volunteered in between our shifts on the bucket brigade going through and like collecting like IDs, wallets, body parts,
you know, shit like that. It was crazy, man.
That was wild.
It was super, super eerie. Dust just floating in the air. It looked like something out of like a horror movie, you know? All the lights and the generators going and shit still smoking and smoldering from seven stories down underneath the towers and stuff.
Which is great. I mean, again, like the crazy thing is it's, I think when a lot of people picture this, it's like, oh man, that was crazy. As that's like one isolated incident, yeah. Except for it's the isolated incident of a Tuesday. And then you go home and you shower.
Right.
And then you go back Wednesday.
Yeah. No, for sure. And it's like, you're back in it. And I'll never forget, the smell is the biggest thing. But so I'm working with all these grown men. You know, I was like 22, 23 at the time, and all these grown men, and I say grown men, they're probably like 30 to 35 at the time now, you know, and like I call them kids now, you know, at 45. Yeah, yeah. But all these soft dudes, right? And super cool, took me under their wing and stuff. And long and short of it, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to go off and do the shit, you know, be the guy. And they're like, look, if you can't get in, go find the most dangerous city in the country to be a cop at.
We were talking about that a little bit earlier, like that military FOMO, for lack of a better
term. For sure. Absolutely. You know? And I had it big time. I had that fear of missing out. I was like, was I good enough? Am I good enough? Would I have been good enough? What do these guys have that I don't have? You know,
it was funny. Again, that military FOMO is how much of that revolves around like unanswered questions. And you know, and what's crazy is, and so, you know, I try not to like discourage people. I mean, maybe that's exactly what I'm doing at times, but I'm just asking questions, not necessarily in the, I don't want to steer people down whatever direction, follow your heart, make whatever decisions you want to make, but do so in the light of day.
Yes.
Right. You know, and weigh out some things that, you know what, maybe you hadn't thought about. I'll never forget, like when I was a senior in high school, my economics teacher gave me about face. Which is actually, you know, super cool. It's actually the whole reason that I ended up getting to the whole Jocko podcast. Someone else has read about face. It was like this weird, you know, early 90s, 80s book that no one else had ever read. But he was asking me questions of like, why do you want to go? Why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do that? And I like, even though I didn't have good answers, my mind was made up.
Right.
You know, it didn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. And you know, like you and I could sit here and tell some young guy or even not so young guy that never went and did it, you know, and I can tell like, dude, don't go into law enforcement, SWAT. Don't go become a SWAT guy. Don't go into contracting. Don't do this. But that's because we did it.
Well, that's the hard part. I mean, and acknowledging, you know, well, yeah, exactly.
We have that experience.
Well, we have the questions answered.
Right.
You know, when we have the questions answered, it's a little bit of an easier, it's because I've seen that, I've watched that, especially, you know, even more being outside of the military, coming into contact with more people that are thinking about it. And, you know, they want to, that's what they're talking, they're planning on going in, you know, yeah, people like leaving good paying jobs, or they're leaving, you know, like they've got steady families, I don't, whatever the case is. And then in my head, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, wait a minute. You know, like, let's think about this. And it's so hard to, you know, and then like the balance of that though would be, well, if what's propelling you in are all these unanswered questions, that's fine. But what are you doing to answer some of the questions now?
Yeah. You know, and there's that. And then I'm not going to lie too, like it's pretty fucking cool rolling up to a target on foot under night vision to put a fucking folding foam linear charge on a door and fucking blow that fucker up.
Knock, knock.
You know, like that's pretty fucking cool. It's pretty fucking cool rolling out of the North CAC of old Embassy Baghdad in blue jeans and Iraqi soccer shirts, oversized, cut over our kit, dressed up like, you know, local Iraqis, jumping into our little old Mercedes and BMWs to go do clandestine, you know, intelligence collection. Like that's pretty badass, you know? Yeah. There's a lot of dumb shit. There's a lot of boring stuff. There's a lot of baggage and scars that we take away from a career of doing that that haunts us now. But I'll be honest, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, I mean, that's the hard part is like having gone through the experience, obviously you're like, well, you know, that these experiences are what gave me the perspective that I have. My question is because as I've been around it more often, I'm like, well, you know, what's the happy medium? Is there a middle ground to, you know, like I can learn, you know, what lessons can we teach, or, you know, what things can people learn about themselves without necessarily having to go do all the same things.
Yeah, I know for sure. And I think it's important for us just to be authentic and not glamorize it, but also not like be self-deprecating with it, you know, because I think that sometimes we have that ability to be like, oh, dude, it's bullshit. Don't fucking do that. And then other times some people are, you know, dude, it's fucking greatest job ever. It's all, like, we just have to be authentic about it. But I don't know. I don't think anything replaces having your life on the line side of a gun, like, period. There's nothing that replaces that.
I mean, that same argument is said about absolutely everything. Like, nothing, you know, really replaces experience.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So you get told, though, that you can't go, like, you're permanently barred, not going in. And then your mentors are basically like, all right, cool. Well, the next best thing is.
Yeah. Go into law enforcement. And I remember specifically one night we were sitting around this bar down in downtown New York, and there were a bunch of Force Recon Marines sitting around the table that had come up to do some work with us, friends of my buddy that were running the detail. And they were telling stories about going down to New Orleans to run full mission exercises, basically. And they're like, man, those guys are in the shit all the time. They shoot more motherfuckers, you know, like, got me. I was like, all right, roger that. That's where I'm going. So I moved down to New Orleans, became a New Orleans cop.
Nice.
And
so, like, with that, having gone through an academy, because again, this is where it's interesting to me, that where most people might start off with becoming a police officer.
Right.
And then as a young kid, or, you know, or I would say younger in their careers, their first experience is having gone through an academy, but you're doing corporate security with what I would imagine is more of like big boy rules, big boy culture.
Absolutely.
In an area that is like, even if the job is what it is, it's still, again, is 9 days after the towers fall. Yeah. And then you come into this environment, into the academy, which is very, very regimented, very, you know, like, I don't want to say reductive in a lot of ways, but that's kind of what basic training felt like.
It absolutely was. You know, here I am. I was working out like a monster because my plan was to go into a soft pipeline. And then I'm working with all these grown men who are either active duty soft or had just recently got out from every branch. And I get to this police academy with a bunch of not young kids, but kids that seemed much younger than me. And I was only 20, now 24.
But even your peer group, you know, I mean, and even the job you had previous to this is, again, filled with a lot of mental stress, whatever.
For sure.
And so maturity is something that happens really fast.
Real fast, or you're fucking gone, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm with this academy class of people that were in less than good shape, you know? Yeah. And in
that was
less,
a really nice
less
way to put
than,
that,
less than motivated. Right. I can be nice. Yeah. The academy was easy for me. It really was. I graduated number one. I think I cleared every award through the academy, from top shooter to fitness to, you know, and it's not because I was that good. I'm not. It's just I had put in a lot more work than everybody else prior to.
Right.
You know, I was in this pipeline. It's not that I was special or better or anything. I just said I'd been busting my ass, you know.
For even a different field or job.
Right, exactly. So I just put in the work and had the training beforehand. So I already knew how to shoot. I was already really good at running and PT and yada, yada, you know.
So it was
easy.
And then you become a police officer and you accomplish that goal. But then like, what was 3 weeks out of the academy like? Did you feel like, you know?
So I got, you know, it's funny how it works. Like in any organization, you get noticed. And I was basically noticed right away. And they're like, all right, this kid Lappin needs to go with this FTO. Because you got to go to 3 months of field training, right, with a field training officer. And I got hand selected to go with this guy who had just gotten out of a long time in narcotics work. Mm. And he became an FTO, which is usually kind of like a nupty position. But he became an FTO because he could pick his shift. And he was a single dad and needed to be able to drop his kids off at school and pick them up.
Right.
So he picked day watch and he got to do that because he became an FTO.
Kudos to that guy who picked a like nifty position to be a single dad.
Right. Absolutely. But he was this young, jacked, yoked, fit dude and didn't give a shit about being like a patrol cop. was still a cop's cop, still a crime fighter.
Yeah.
So I got put with him, and he, like, you know, day one out of the academy, I'm like, we're in roll call. We go out to get to our car. We're checking our car, and I'm like, hey, do you want me to put us 10-8 on the radio? 10-8 means like we're in service. Mm. He's like, no. He's like, call dispatch, give them our unit number, and tell them we're at the station doing vehicle maintenance. I was like, okay, you know, whatever. I was like, 212. Yeah, we're at the station doing unit vehicle maintenance. Okay, 212. And we get in the car and we drive off. And I'm like, I thought we were doing. He's like, no.
I've been in this job for 1 week, dude. You're going to get me fired.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, no, you see all these calls for service on the computer? You see all these dumb reports that need to be taken for some bullshit burglary or car accident, car crash? We don't want any of those. He's like, we're going to let all the slugs take those. We're going out to catch some bad guys. And literally, he drove me right to the worst part of town. And literally, within like 30 minutes of my very first shift, I'm in a foot chase, chasing this dude. You chase him down an alley, tackle him, get into a fight, get him in handcuffs. And he's just watching me. He's like, fucking roger that. All right, Lappin, like, you're okay with me. And I told him after that, I sat down. I said, hey, look, I said, I know I'm a new guy. I don't know the job. I don't know how to be a cop. I don't. And I'm looking to you to learn and have you teach me the ins and outs of being a cop. But I'll tell you this. What I've done for the past 3 years has prepped me. I will never not be by your side. I will chase anyone down right next to you, and I'll always have your fucking back. And I know how to fight. Yeah. And he was like, "Fucking, I can work with that, Lappin." You know. And that's I basically learned to be a narcotics cop. Like my first cycle of FTO.
I would love if, as an FTO, he had like one informant that was like his sprinter.
Yeah.
What I mean? That was like his guy.
Go. I'm going to bring my new guy to you. Take off. You know?
And if he catches you, he's in. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that was it, dude. It was a test. But what's funny is like you rotate through three FTOs, right?
Yeah.
And so I spent like a whole month with him learning how to be a cop, like really be a cop. And then I got to my second FTO who all he wanted to do was sleep on shift. So I'm in the car driving, he's sleeping, and I'm making full dope arrests by myself without even waking him up. I ended up getting in trouble for it, actually.
Of course, because that's exactly how an organization like that would function. I ended up
getting in trouble for it, but
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So didn't spend much time on patrol. Out of FTO, was same thing, a pretty proactive young patrolman, not making sure I knew all the ins and outs to not have to go take that burglary report or that little traffic accident, you know, and I was going out and making dope arrests and gun arrests and stuff like that. And I got quickly moved to what's called a task force, which is like a strictly proactive unit, and then just kind of moved up through.
What's so funny is to me how like law enforcement works. I mean, a lot of organizations work like this, but I don't think that when you're growing up or when you're an outsider, you don't necessarily like know or think about it, which is, there's like really good gigs and there's really terrible gigs.
Yes.
And like 3 years of your life might be like the absolute best and you love your job. And then you get transferred over into some like,
and it's the worst.
You're like, why am I even here?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
For any length of time. Yeah.
And I mean, I had that. I went from the best gig to being reassigned to the horse stables.
Nice. You're strong. You look like you can shovel a lot of.
Yeah, exactly. I shovel a lot of shit. But yeah. When after that shooting that I was telling you about, they reassigned me while I was under investigation.
Dang, so, dude. Yeah. I wanted to ask you. You said that you were in New Orleans when Katrina went down.
Yep. Yeah, I was a cop in New Orleans. I was New Orleans cop when Katrina hit, and that was pretty wild.
So yeah, from an emergency services standpoint, like Katrina gets categorized, like impact is freaking imminent, and what conversations are you guys having as police officers to go?
It was wild. Me specifically, I was with the group. We went down to our academy. And we went and like cleared out the armories, cleared out a bunch of like all our like CI files, a lot of CI files, stuff where, you know, confidential information was kept there. Computers, etc., and we moved all that shit up to headquarters, which is a multi-story building, got it up high. as like the storm's rolling in, like
were you guys for, like up. Like when it was all said and done, did like you look back and go, yeah, that was exactly as much like bedlam as we predicted? Or you were like, holy freaking, what did you learn about people during Katrina?
Within 3 hours of no services, the savages come out. The predators come out within 3 hours.
Wild.
3 hours of no or limited services, the predators will start coming out and testing the waters. Within 3 days.
What kind of tests did you see?
I mean, looting primarily. That was the first thing that happened. Within 3 hours, all the electronic stores and gun stores were getting looted.
Boom.
Within 3 hours. That was the first thing, the first like thing that we noticed. And then within 3 days of no services, everyone turns into a savage.
Yeah, that's like one of my favorite, like where civilization is 72 hours or 9 meals away.
Yes, yeah.
From chaos.
Absolutely 100% fucking true, 100% true.
A buddy of mine in the Army, he was, he lived further up north when Katrina rolled through, but afterwards he was like responding and he was telling us stories about even in the, like, in the orange road guard vest. And I mean, all the things like trying to do humanitarian stuff, him being shot at just simply because they had supplies and equipment, and all kinds of crazy nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, we were on the high rise interstate. We're backing our trailers and boats down the ramp into the water.
Oh, man.
Right. And while we're trying to launch boats, we're getting shot at from the third story of the housing projects and stuff. To launch boats to go rescue people that are stuck on overpasses, stuck on their roofs, shit like that.
Yeah. And I mean, and who's, is this orchestrated? Is this opportunistic?
Opportunistic. Is this- yeah. New Orleans is so messed up. New Orleans does not have gangs per se. They have all these little neighborhoods and little families and street corners. They're not organized. God forbid an organized gang ever came into New Orleans. They'd run everything. But yeah, opportunistic, you know, like just hoodlums from, you know, and just getting shot at, shooting at us with AKs from third story buildings and stuff, and just pop shots whenever they could. Once we kind of secured certain areas, secured the headquarters, police headquarters, because a lot of like the families were staying there, big generator on the roof, you know, multi-story building.
Yeah.
In the area that I worked in, which the majority of that area actually didn't flood, that's where all the limousine service places were kept in the industrial area. So all the limos, all the Lincoln Town cars, all that stuff, well, they were all getting broken into and stolen, and the bad guys were using those for drive-bys on us.
Dang.
So anytime we'd see a black limo or a black Lincoln Town car, we'd jump into our units and take off. And I mean, have like literally driving down the street, running gunfights with these limos. Like, yeah. And you know, if we shot them up, we just left them there.
Yeah.
There was no morgue. There was no, our lockup flooded. There's no place to bring anybody. So we just leave them there and head back.
Absolutely. And now again, like people caught in the middle, again, trapped in overpasses where, you know, like what did some of those rescues look like? You had to have been like launching boats and been like, you know what? I don't remember them talking about this in the academy.
One of the big ones that comes to mind is we were with a National Guard unit in a 5-ton. Mm-hmm. And we were cruising into an area that got really deep, really deep. And we're on this overpass and we get to this area of the water that's just too deep for the 5-ton. We couldn't drive through it. And we're waiting there and we're hanging out and there's some people there milling about, giving them MREs, making sure they've got enough. And we couldn't take everybody back. And a fan boat, Louisiana, right? A fan boat comes cruising up with this lady on it and like a whole family. And the fan boat comes up and the lady is probably 400 pounds and has a trash bag over one of her legs, a fresh amputation. And the trash bag's bleeding.
Dang.
Right. And a couple young kids.
Fresh amputation from?
I think it was
surgery
like,
prior.
Surgery prior. Yeah. I think it was like diabetic amputation, before the storm, not storm related.
Right.
And they were holed up in their house.
But not nothing,
right?
Yeah.
And they had a couple mentally handicapped kids with them. And we needed an evacuator. We put a tourniquet on her and we're like, fuck, how are we going to get her up into this 5-ton, 400-pound woman with an amputated leg, you know? and
bleeding in a trash bag.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's not, yeah, that's yeah. not, that's also not nothing.
That's not nothing. And there happened to be like a work truck stuck on the overpass that just couldn't go anywhere. And it had a big sheet of plywood in it, in the back of it. So I'm like, let's grab the plywood. If we all grab around the edge, we can probably load on the plywood, get her slider up onto the 5 ton. So that's what we did.
Are we talking like 3/4 inch?
Yeah, yeah, or? Yeah, yeah. It wasn't 7/16. Yeah, yeah. But it worked. You know, we got her on the 5 ton and got all the kids and the family and got them to an area where there was actual medical help to get them, you know, get them out of there. A lot of medvacs, obviously, a lot of helicopters moving people out with serious injuries and stuff.
And obviously that's of like particular interest to me as well, as like, what did emergency medicine look like in terms of, you know, there's obviously these people with, I'd say, pre-existing conditions.
Right.
And that's a problem.
Yes.
And then you have a storm roll through and then you have what I would call maybe like disease, non-battle injury.
Yes.
Like, and that's a problem. Oh, and yeah. then you have people having accidents and all these other things. Percentage wise, again, like inside of this bedlam disaster, what did you see? I don't want to limit to just the most as, but it's like primarily like, what are you coming in contact with?
So, me and my guys, I was wet for probably 5 days straight. Like same BDU uniform. We wore navy blue BDUs, same BDU uniform, probably wet for 5 days in water that was filled with oil, fuel, sewage, you name it, everything. And to the point where we're all getting rashes and broken out, you know, little cuts you'd had to. And one of the guys that I worked with started having like inflammation on his foot real bad, and he had a cut on his ankle, and to the point where he couldn't walk, and now his boots untied and he's hobbling around. He ended up getting his foot amputated.
Yeah. Well, he couldn't go down to like urgent care.
Right. No, then there was yeah, none of that, you know. Exactly. And it's like, unless it was like something catastrophic, like we didn't be like, hey dude, I need to get flown out of here. You right. know, no, it was a cut. Yeah. My foot hurts. My ankle hurts until it's too bad.
Yeah.
And then it was done. So yeah, he ended up getting his foot amputated. But fuck, he walked around on that foot, dude, for like 2 weeks, you know. Like he ended up basically having to pull security at a Walmart that we commandeered to live out of. And yeah, he ended up getting his foot amputated.
What were the rules for that? Like, do you get on the phone and like have to say, hey, Walmart, like we're commandeering your...
No, so we got there because the Walmart was getting looted.
I guess that doesn't really, you know, if you're commandeering it, that's not very cool.
Right, no.
It's much cooler to just like kick in the sliding doors and be like, hey, everybody out. Yeah.
Well, the doors were already kicked in by the looters.
Yeah. Convenient.
Yeah, so we went in, chased all the looters out, basically. And our station had flooded. So we moved all our vehicles away, and that's what we ended up taking over. We found a refrigeration truck. And of course, none of the looters loot the food. They were all looting the electronics section and firearm section, right?
Yeah, I really hope we come to a point in the story where they live to regret that.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Some of them didn't live to regret it, but yeah.
Yeah, there's also that outcome.
But yeah, so we ended up taking like a lot of the refrigerated foods and frozen meats and stuff and putting them in this refrigeration truck. And we built a couple of barbecues and took propane. And we were sleeping on like fold out lawn chairs and stuff from the Walmart. And that's where we slept. We moved a bunch of like vehicles and stuff around the other entry points. We had one ECP, VCP coming in. That's a vehicle control point or entry control point, coming in and out of the Walmart parking lot. And, that's where we lived. We slept on fold out lawn chairs, cooked food on the barbecues that we made from Walmart. And that's where we were living, bro.
It was kind of wild. I mean, again, just even from an experience standpoint, the fact that you were, like in the aftermath of the towers falling.
Yeah.
And then, you know what I mean? Like,
and then fast forward.
And then, you know, like just a few years later, there you are again inside of the chaos of Katrina.
And then literally just a year after that, I was in Port-au-Prince, Haiti during an attempted coup. And we had to go down to the our MSG Marines house and rescue them because the house was getting surrounded and taken over. So yeah, I guess... I don't know if you're lucky to be with me or not lucky to be with me.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a, you know, you have a tendency to attract disasters.
Watch out, Fieldcraft.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and you said that to go to Haiti, you took a leave of absence.
Yeah, so after Katrina, things got settled, went back to kind of status quo, you know, back to our old jobs and stuff. And
how long did that take?
Oh, you know, a lot of people want to like tell crazy stories. Oh, for 2 weeks, for a month, it was, man, it was bad for a few days. Mm-hmm. It was bad for like really bad for a few days where we were like in the thick of it. Lots of shootings, lots of really gnarly rescues, jumping in the water, climbing up on people's roofs, swimming through shit to get into their house. Like,
yeah,
pretty. Sorry.
We're good.
Pretty gnarly shit. Lots of kids caught up in it and stuff, and kids that didn't survive. But, I mean, really, like, after, like, a week-ish, things started residing, drying up. The water kind of came back, dried up. People were evacuated, you know?
Yeah.
And then there was obviously the lawlessness still because there were no lights, there were no traffic lights. We still didn't have a real return to service, but we had a lot of support from other agencies coming in.
Right. Even though the infrastructure basically is non-existent.
Exactly, exactly. But, like, we had—
How long did that take? I mean, obviously there's probably very, I mean, like,
yeah,
it wasn't just all of a sudden the light got switched.
Right. No. And like, so I'll say like within a week, mm-hmm. they had built a makeshift jail at our Amtrak train bus station out of concertina wire and fence, you know? So with, now we had a jail.
With a built-in moat probably.
Still. Yeah, exactly. A built-in moat around it. Yeah. And no convenient. Shit, crocodiles and sharks and shit. I say alligators, sorry, crocodiles.
Right.
You know what's funny is like when a lot of the water resided on the highways, on the overpass highways,
yeah.
dead fish, dead sharks, gators, like fucking washed in from the canals and bayous and lake and stuff. It was wild.
Yeah, it was wild.
So no, like within a week or so, things started slowing down. You know, and also people don't really want to fight that much when they're starving to death and dehydrated. It was hot as shit. It was August.
That's helpful.
You know, it was August 28th when the storm hit. So it's like, we're in the thick of the summer in New Orleans. Like, it's hot as shit. So if you didn't loot water and food, after a couple of days, you're dying. Like, yeah, literally dying. Yeah, 100%.
You know? I mean, because again, at this point, you can't just go to the store and pick it up.
That's right. So, you know, the National Guard was doing MRE drops throughout the city. And that's a whole nother thing because we kept having these old couples come back day after day to get more MREs. We're like, where's the shopping cart full that we just gave you? And some of the thugs were stealing them from them and then trying to sell them back to them.
Dang, of course.
So we were dealing with that. But yeah, you know, things started calming down after about a week and a few days and then 2 weeks and a month, you know, it was getting back to normal. I'd say by like mid-October, things were kind of, I mean, this don't get me wrong. The city was still in ruins.
Yeah.
But services were restored. You know, housing was getting dealt with. People were getting moved around. They brought in cruise ships to house people, all that stuff.
I just, you know, this is something that comes up all the time when I think about, again, like everyone's like, oh, hey, you need to have a disaster kit. And then a disaster kit, I would say that the stereotypical answer is how long?
You could not have built a disaster kit for this.
Like 72 hour. Oh, yeah. I've got my 72 hour kit. I've got my this,
you're
my
still
that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, okay, well that might've gotten you through the storm, but what about the subsequent 2 weeks?
Right.
You know, like, and again, and I would love to, and even if anybody actually like knows, hit me up on Instagram about this, like the fires in Maui.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Again, like how, like life doesn't just all of a sudden turn back on in 72 hours, in a week, in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks.
No.
I mean, and again, depending on how much support you get from outside age, whatever the case is, like a disaster is a lot more long lasting, I think,
sure.
than what planning looks like.
It's funny. A lot of these disasters, September 11th included, Katrina, some of the stuff that I experienced overseas in both Haiti and over in Iraq, a couple other areas, is one of the reasons I've always had a built out truck.
Yeah.
Because they want to talk about build out a disaster kit. No, fuck a disaster kit. Build out a disaster vehicle that can get you out of just about anything. So something that's four-wheel drive, off-road capable, enough ground clearance to clear a decent amount of water or debris, and have a chainsaw and enough fuel.
Okay, I mean, this comes up all the time too. I'm like, the very first thing, like if I bought a new car tomorrow, the very first thing that I would start looking at for that car is an extended gas tank.
Yes, for sure.
I mean, like the whole damn thing runs on freaking gasoline.
That's right.
And if that's not the first upgrade to make my portable generator like last longer.
That's right. Well, it's funny. And I don't even know. It was something that I picked up when I was working with the guys down in at Ground Zero is, and it's always stuck with me, was never let your vehicle get under a half a tank.
Yeah.
Never. So that was something that I preached. And I would, if I hit a half a tank, I filled up. Half a tank, filled up. So that's something we live by, you know, is never let our tanks, our fuel tanks, get less than half a tank. And yeah, you know, the only thing for Katrina was to leave, was to get out of there. You know, there was really nothing you could do to have prepared to stay.
But even then, so even like, but what does that evacuation look like when everyone has the exact same notice, makes the exact same decision, you know? And even then, like a lot of those people that even if they made the decision to go, where did they go?
Congested roads. Whereas if you let your car sit on a quarter tank of gas, you're running out of gas on the highway.
Right.
You know, people going north into like Alabama, Mississippi, or going west into Texas.
Yeah. Mike Hernandez has a story that he was talking to me about, like with some of the fires in California of people, everybody evacuating. And then because of the fire, there's a closure in front of the road and people have to then now reroute.
That's right.
And then it was a two wheel drive vehicle that tried to get over this like clearance. They got stuck and basically boned everybody behind them.
That's right.
You know? And so even if you're that person in the capable vehicle, this person, like the congested road in front of you.
That's right.
Might be a game stopper.
That's right. 100%. Absolutely. So yeah, it's, you know, like, but yeah, you know, like obviously proper preparation. What's the
early saying? Warning?
Well, early warning. What's the five P's? You know, proper preparation prevents piss poor performance.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Be prepared. Be, you know, be ready. Have your gear. And by gear, I mean like, you know, whether it's some MREs and some water. Like I joke around, but my plan now, like living in Louisiana, I'm just moved out here to Utah, but we deal with hurricanes, Hurricane Katrina. We deal with hurricanes. Where I live now is not really so much in threat of flooding per se, but the areas around it are. And then we talk about civil unrest that happens when services get delayed, right? And the predators come out, the shitheads come out.
Well, I mean, and even depending on where you live, I mean, it's helpful when you're like, hey, you know what? Every year we seem to have really big storms.
Right.
So we can at least start, you know, so that's a pretty common course of action.
For sure.
But the needs don't change.
The needs don't change.
Sustenance, I mean, is still like.
And, you know, we know when it's going to happen too. So it's like mid-August to like second week of September.
Yeah. I'm a huge pirate nerd. And the rule back in the day was like not to set sail after September.
Yeah, there you go.
Because
you were boned. Keep your powder dry.
Yeah.
Do you know what one of my favorite pirate code commandment is?
What's that?
Rum is for drinking, not for burning.
Yeah.
That's an actual pirate commandment.
Love it.
We'll talk about pirate shit.
Oh, hell yeah.
But, you know, so what do I do? I make sure my chainsaw is prepped and ready to go. I make sure my chainsaw starts. It's got fresh fluids in it. I make sure I get extra two-stroke gas for it that's treated, you know.
Full spectrum planning. You know, like this is one of the biggest things that I think that I love about, again, meeting and talking to different people, like, you know, like around the building, is how often that stuff comes up is one of the greatest gifts I think that I probably have from all my different experience is the fact that finding gaps in planning, like risk mitigation is really what the name of the game ends up being.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's like really what we should be absolutely best at is that risk mitigation and making, even if the plan changed, a plan is a commonly understood basis for change, that's fine, you know, but not having gaps in planning. And what are the biggest gap is, man, there's a Murphy's Law that I'll forget for this, but it basically, you know, just because we say things doesn't make it so.
That's right.
72 hour kid. You know what I mean? Well, who said that this is going to last 72?
Where did that come from? Yeah, like who said the 72 hour, you know, it's like.
Yeah, something's always better than nothing.
For
but,
sure.
But why would we stop there?
And you know what's funny though is like you say 72 hour kit, but I basically at my old house, I basically made sure that I had enough water and food for 3 days. Mm. Right? 72 hours. Anything beyond that, I'm going to forage or hunt for. Right? Where I lived, we could hunt, we could fish. People turn into savages and like I had, you know, a well-regulated militia where we had like myself and the guys on my SWAT team, like we had a whole plan together. obviously being part of a SWAT team and that sort of response, we would go out and do a lot of work in our high water rescue vehicles and stuff during the storms. But we had a whole no comms plan to meet up if we had no comms, stuff like that. So the fact of the matter is, like, you know, if I needed more food or water after 3 days and couldn't get it through legal means, then I'm going to take it through
means, whatever freaking, you know, means I absolutely have to. Yeah. I mean, and obviously it's like there's always limitations even to storage, you know, like where do we put all these things?
Right.
That comes up in vehicles and stuff all the time as well. But that's the sustainment part of planning is, okay, this is what supplies, sustenance, whatever, what that always translates to is time.
Yeah.
Time and decisions. Like, I don't have to go out to get this because I have it.
Because I have it. And yeah. I don't have to risk, you know, I'm just like,
I don't have to go compete for resources right now because that can get dangerous.
Fuel being one of them. You know, I have I drive a big truck. I drive a truck that can basically go through about 4 feet of water, you know? And during this last hurricane we had, Ida, 2 years ago now, I got connected with a guy who could get 50 gallon drums of fuel. And I was like, fucking send it. Yeah, we'll hook a trailer up to my truck and we're going to get them. We strapped down a bunch of 50 gallon drums of fuel and had a hand crank pump. And we were sitting on enough fuel forever.
Right.
You know,
your own strategic reserve.
Yeah. So like that was almost pre-planned. Like, we knew the hurricane was coming. We sought this opportunity and we jumped on it.
Yeah, right.
We jumped on it. So
timing,
but pre-planning, you know, being prepared. So being
able how long after Katrina did you end up looking into the world of contracting? Because I would imagine it might go something like, dude, you have this crazy experience and then coming down from that, where again,
yeah,
you know, now depending on what your job is, even like on what a regular beat is, you know, or even doing investigation, whatever, that can still. I don't want to say like fill a void, but man, it's, you know,
for sure.
What goes up must come down.
Yeah, for sure. And so Katrina was 28 August in 2005. And I think by November, I was up in, if I remember, it was Winchester, Virginia at Bill Scott Raceway doing the triple canopy selection course.
Nice.
And at the time, it was really only open to soft guys, but I had become really good friends with a retired SF guy who worked for Triple Canopy, lived down in New Orleans. We actually met through the dog park, became really, really good buddies. And during Katrina, at some point, later in Katrina, not like the first week, but the next week and a half-ish, he wanted to see if he could come into the city, check on his house. I was like, yeah, dude, I'll come pick you up at the border. So I went down to my unit, picked him up, escorted him in. And there was no power in the city still. The pump stations had power working off these big generators in the city to keep pumping water out and not letting water keep flooding in.
Yeah.
And his house just happened to sit on the corner of one of these pump stations. So literally his house was the only house with power in the entire fucking area.
Convenient.
So we figured that out and we made it a little base of operations. So me and a few of my guys, we were sleeping on like cots and stuff on the floor in AC now.
That's an upgrade from the lawn chairs.
Which was amazing. Yeah, because we hadn't been in AC. You know, it was like, again, it's summertime in New Orleans. Like, if anyone's been down there, it's fucking Africa hot down there.
Yeah,
you know? It's like, so now we're sleeping in AC, we're playing poker at night and stuff or whenever we're not working, you know? And, anyway,
upgrade your circumstances.
Exactly. You know, he's like, hey, you know, have you thought about leaving this and going to contract? And I basically said, I thought it was not open to me, you know, I'm a cop.
Yeah.
He's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Well, I'll push your resume up. And then once you get to selection, you're on your own. I said, okay, I can live with that.
Yeah.
So I went to Triple Canopy selection. I'll never forget. The first day, they wheel us all up in these 15-pack vans, right? And there's probably like 40-something of us. And, you know, you get out of the vans and the lead instructor's like, guys, grab your bags, go inside the classroom. Your names are in alphabetical order on the desks. And go ahead, put your bags in the back of the classroom, have a seat. You do just that. Grab your bag, put it in the back of the room. You generally, Jones, right? You kind of know in a big classroom where your name's going to fall. You go to that area first, you find the J's and you sit down. Well, I did the same thing, Lappin. I kind of know where my name's going to fall. I went there and sat down. And the last dude, he's like wandering around looking for his name, right? Everyone's sitting down. The last
dude. His name's like Adams.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, exactly. You know? And the lead instructor was like, hey, sir, what's your name? And said his name, whatever it was. Sergeant fuckhead, whatever, you know? Mm. And he's like, oh, go ahead, grab your bag, head back out to the van, sir. Poof, gone like that. Like literally like hour one of selection. And the dude's like, the dude at the front of the class was like, hey, gents, like this is not a pass fail. This is like, we're only taking the best out of this group. This is not, and this was the early day of contracting.
Yeah. These
were early days. And like, we don't need any of you. So we're only taking the best of you. And if you're the last motherfucker to find your name in alphabetical order, then something don't work right in your brain. And that means there's 42 other better dudes in here than you, you know?
Right.
I was like, oh fuck. All right. I better mind my P's and Q's, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, fast forward.
Was this like your first like selection kind this of was like process?
Yeah. I mean, other than like the academy, which was nothing and like, you know.
Right. I mean, that's everyone else that signed up.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, this was like my first like big boy selection. And it was 30 days and they picked 15 of us and 15 of us graduated and went on to work for Triple Canopy at the time. Nice. So it was cool. Yeah.
Yeah. You said you went down to Haiti.
Yeah. My first deployment was Haiti. Spent like 6 months down in Port-au-Prince. Doing PSD shit for the embassy, USAID, presidential detail stuff. Good experience, you know, worked with all soft dudes pretty much. That's where I kind of started to build my reputation of, you know, hey, Lappin's not a shitbird, you know?
Right.
Sometimes I am.
Yeah. So. Depends on the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, depends on the day. You said you found jujitsu just before this though also. You found jujitsu kind of early then.
So I found jujitsu like, I heard about jiu-jitsu way early. I'm talking like mid 90s.
Yeah.
So I lived in California as a kid for several years.
Okay.
And played ice hockey out there and started boxing out there with my best friend's dad, who was a Golden Gloves boxer. We played ice hockey together. Fast forward, moved back to New Jersey and went back to visit my buddy. And I want to say this was like 92, 93. So literally like right after the first UFC pretty much.
Yeah.
And nobody knew what Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was.
Nope.
And I show up, I get picked up at the airport, go to my buddy's house, and him and his brother are in these like white karate uniforms with these like yellow belts, like way long hanging down their knees. I'm like, what are you? They're like, oh, we got to go to jiu-jitsu practice. And I'm like, what? Karate? They're like, no, do you want to come with us? I was like, all right, I guess. So I go with them and I walk in this little tiny white building with this sea of green mat, this dark green mat. And I sit down and I fill out a waiver or whatnot. And this dude comes in who's kind of like tall and just gawky, gangly looking, hair's all messed up, dark skin. He's Brazilian, big black eye. It was Royce Gracie.
Dang.
It was Royce. He was teaching class. Wow. Shows up late, typical Brazilian style, right? Shows up late. Oh yeah, guy, I got a fight at the bar last night, bro, you know, mm-hmm. And that's what the black eye was from. And, I tried jiu-jitsu for the first time and I was 14. It's 14, maybe 13, 14.
What'd you think about it when you had your first?
I had no idea. I didn't know what it was. I was like, okay, we're wrestling, but I'm getting my ass kicked. I'm getting tied up like a pretzel.
Yeah.
Like I'm pretty strong and athletic. And I went back to New Jersey and nothing ever again because there was no jiu-jitsu where I was living at the time. So I dabbled in wrestling a little bit, got into Muay Thai, studied Muay Thai for several years. It was a logical kind of progression from just boxing. And fast forward to 2004-ish when I was a cop in New Orleans and I was like, oh, I need to learn how to like really grapple. So I started training at a local academy in the city of New Orleans as a cop when I was a cop there. And that's when I really started training jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. You know, like I wish that I could convey that when people first start out. Like I get the same thing. I had a buddy that he'd been rolling for a long time, invited me out to an academy in Hawaii and went and did like one night. And I had like even some BJJ experience. I don't even say experience because that's not right. But like in the military, like like the combative program off of similar stuff. So I was at least aware of a little bit of it, but I still like, I couldn't see where it was. So I went to like one night and then fell off my radar for years.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It fell off my radar for basically 12 years. And now I'm a cop in New Orleans. I'm like, I need to learn how to grapple. Went down to the local jiu-jitsu academy, started training there. Like most kids, when you're young and strong and athletic, you think the gi is stupid. So I only wanted to train no gi, which was which is stupid. Kids, people, don't just train no gi, please. Train the fucking gi.
100%. Right?
Trained for basically like a year and a half while I was a cop, and then started deploying. You know, took that leave out, started deploying. And I was deploying on and off. I'd bring a gi with me. I'd train a little bit at whatever team I was at. You know, there's always some guy who trained jiu-jitsu, a little jiu-jitsu group. And I'd train, and then I wouldn't train for a couple months. And then I'd train and wouldn't train for a couple months. So I dabbled for like several years, like almost 8 years. I just kind of dabbled wearing a white belt.
Yeah. I mean, which is a super hard way to do it, by the way. One of the best. Yeah. It's like one of the best ways it was ever conceptualized to me was how like it was by a guy named if I get it wrong, I'm gonna feel super upset, so I'm gonna apologize in advance. But Keeling Taylor, I think he's a black belt out of Victory MMA, I think is one of the first spots that I went. And he was like telling me how it's a language. Jiu-jitsu's a language, and you learn, coming into conversations is gonna be really awkward at first. You're gonna have a hard time communicating. You're not gonna understand a lot of what's trying to be communicated in general, but you learn it by immersion. Yeah. And slowly you understand, you know, passive and active, you understand passive, like defense, just holding on for my dear life.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And active, finally being able to, I can generate some offense. Like I can be the one actually saying a few things.
That's right.
And it being, you know, doing more of the questioning and less of the answering.
That's right. And next thing you know, you're teaching the language.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I get it all the time where it's like, bigger, stronger guys, like, how did you get my arm? Well, you gave me your arm. I didn't give you my arm. Yeah, you did. You gave me your arm. I didn't give you my arm. I was holding on to it. No. Remember when I pushed on your other elbow and you reached like that to stop me from, you gave me your arm. Well, how'd you know I was going to do that? Well, because I know. Yeah. I know you're going to do that.
Because everyone does that.
Because everybody does that. Right. Yeah. So then you start like, you know, and then you start making your own language, really. Because then you start inventing little tweaks to all these techniques and building your own version of it. So yeah, so trained jiu-jitsu, dabbled through my contracting career. Jiu-jitsu has saved my life literally and figuratively, using it in actual use of force fights. Fought a guy over a gun. Guy pulled a gun on me out of a car door. Like I was right there to like grab him. And could have done all this cool John Wick shit. Didn't do anything cool at all. Saw this big silver Beretta 92.
Opportunity missed.
Yeah,
man.
Exactly. Opportunity missed. I could have like done this. I could have like slashed him with my knife and contact shot him. Yeah, no, I didn't do any of that. Saw a silver Beretta 92 that looked like a giant toy gun almost. You know, it was so big.
So you know you're dealing with an amateur.
Right, yeah. Yeah. It ended up being stolen. It was actually had this dude's name engraved in it. We got it back to the owner. It was a retirement gift to a Air Force guy.
Yeah.
So I had his name engraved. It was like a chrome Beretta 92. Mm-hmm. Anyway, fought him over the gun. I'm here, obviously. So I won the fight. And but didn't do anything cool. Didn't do anything sexy. 2-on-1 on the gun. Wrist control. Finally swung an underhook. A couple headbutts, I think. Pinned him against the B-pillar of the car. Knee tapped him down to the ground, stripped the gun out of his hands, started fighting, got him in handcuffs, but you know,
boom.
So fast forward, contracting, dabbled throughout contracting, and then got selected for a job in the UAE.
Yeah.
And this was 2013, very, very beginning of 2013. And the UAE imports Brazilian black belts to work full time. Teaching the public school system and teaching the law enforcement military academies, police and military academies.
Dang, that's wild.
And I became good buddies with a black belt there named Tiago Bravo. He became really like my first real professor, and dude just like really taught me the culture and lifestyle of jiu-jitsu, which was rad. So I had like near private training with all these black belts that were high level competitive black belts and just got fucking destroyed. Like I was so nervous about going to training for like the first year. Cause I just get killed. Lily pad wants some attention. I was just getting killed, you know? And like, I'd be driving to practice and been like, just maybe if someone gives me a little fender bender, if I get a little fender bender, then I don't have to go, you know, like maybe I should turn around here and like claim an illness or something like trying to, and I go, you know, I go and I get mauled for an hour, but it really like gave me the love for jiu-jitsu. Lily, come here. My Malinois is being needy, people. Gave me the love for jiu-jitsu and turned me into as much of a savage as you can be as a blue belt, but like,
which is kind of savage.
Yeah, which is kind of savage, bro. But like, I had a lot of like very private personal instruction from black belts, like crazy, and had a pretty good blue belt game at the time. Moved back home to the States in 2017. And there was only one gym in the area at the time. And I went to visit that gym to do like a free trial. Mm-hmm. And I was a blue belt. I had not trained now for 3 months because I had done this big international move and got back. And I went to the gym. And the night that I went, there were no black belts there. There were a couple purple belts, a brown belt. And I murked everybody. And I was like, oh, this is not the gym for me. Yeah, there's no way I should be murking. Because the purple belts that I trained with in Abu Dhabi fucking killed me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I was like, ooh, this is not, this should not happen. So fast forward, I was driving all the way into the city a few days a week. I had matted out my garage and met some guys locally from that gym that we'd started training in my garage. And that was kind of the impetus for Vita. I told, you know, at the time I told my wife, I was like, we need to open up a gym now here. Otherwise someone else will do it.
Right.
So exactly. We opened up an academy. I was a blue belt when we opened, but I brought in a third degree black belt as the professor of the academy. And I basically told him I will not teach any of the adult classes until I'm at least a purple belt. And I taught the kids classes. He taught the adult classes. He was the head professor. I had been a blue belt at that time now for like 3 years, I think. Mm-hmm. So within like 2 or 3 months of opening, I got promoted to purple belt. And yeah, the kind of the rest is history, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's I can't even emphasize that enough, how the transition into that. So, I mean, even before, same thing, like I had, you know, you do like combatives, you know, right. Combatives day, which is really just them making us like shrimp across the freaking lawn all day long.
Yeah. Yeah.
you'd like learn nothing. And those experiences of like, you know, or I had a couple buddies that were in jiu-jitsu and we would do like combative stuff for like preps for competitions, you know, right. NCO of the year or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would do stuff like that. And still that like didn't ever piece together or conceptualize again, like learning a language. It's so much different than fast forward years later when I finally was in an academy going, you know, 2 to 3 times a week.
Right.
You know,
and like really training.
And exactly. Initially actually trying to like grow and learn and develop with it.
Yeah.
So it was a thing.
No, for sure. I mean, there's something to be said for training, backyard training, garage training.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no replacement for training at an academy with a real professor and real training partners.
With progression in mind.
With progression in mind. And like, you know, I've got a buddy who goes, man, I hate the Brazilian dude. Good buddy of mine, Joel. And he goes, man, I hate the garage guys. I was like, Joel, I was a garage guy. Oh, you're different, bro.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
But
I wouldn't have said that if I knew you were
Yeah. You know? But no, I mean, I was only a garage guy because it was like a means to an end. There was no other viable option. And I was like, okay, I need to open an academy, get a black belt and get a black belt in here. Not like get my own black belt, like get a black belt to work and run the academy with me. And that's what I did. The rest is history. Yeah.
Okay. There's one big thing, dude, that I didn't get a chance to ask you about, which was, you know, when you were in New Orleans and in between a lot of this contracting stuff, you said that you got a chance to do a lot of investigating and narcotics and stuff and even like getting to do an undercover stint.
Yeah.
Which is one thing that I think is like anyone growing, if you're like your kid growing up and you want to be a police officer.
Yeah.
I imagine at some point you're like, I want to be undercover.
Yeah, yeah, I want to be undercover. You know. Being undercover sucks.
Well, I've watched The Departed enough.
That's right. That's right. To know it sucks, right? I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio, being undercover sucks. I equate it much like, you know, like everyone wants to be a sniper until you have to lay in a hide and get crawled on by shit and like have to take a piss right then. It's like, no, you don't want to be a sniper, dude.
Yeah.
And I say that I was never a sniper. I got to go to a sniper school and I was like, nah, I don't want to be a sniper, you know?
You don't even have to have that experience. I mean, again, just even like, it's the same thing of like laying in on like doing surveillance. For That's example.
Right. Oh,
yeah. I mean, there's plenty of jobs that we can equate that to. If you've just sat and laid down and waited for an ambush, you know, for someone just to walk through, you're like,
that's right.
This is kind of lame.
This sucks. All right. Sitting in a surveillance van in downtown New Orleans and like having to piss in Gatorade bottles and stuff.
Right.
It's funny. I had a female partner for a while. We were sitting in our surveillance van, and it's like a work van, right? You know, AT&T or Bell, you know, Bell AT&T sticker, magnets on the side of it and stuff. And I was like, fuck. Her name was Athena. I was like, Athena, I gotta fucking piss. She's like, well, piss. And she's like, I'll turn around. I'm like, whatever, I don't care. And so I go in the back, and you always bring the wide mouth Gatorade bottles. That's the key to doing surveillance.
Well, of course.
Yeah, or road trips. So I'm pissing in this Gatorade bottle. And she's like, hearing you pee, now I got to pee really bad. And so I finished pissing, and I'm like, all right, you know, go in the back. And I had a gallon jug of water. And I was like, look, it was almost empty. I was like, I'll cut the top off so it's a big wide thing, right? And just squat over it. And so I use my knife and I cut the top off the gallon thing of water. And she goes in the back, and she's like squatting and balancing, and like, she stumbles and knocks it over and like pisses all over herself. And it was just a mess, bro.
Dude, that should be a whole nother podcast that we do, which is pissing and shitting inside of vehicles.
Yes.
And just poop stories in general.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
That'll actually,
oh yeah, there you go.
That'll be the most successful podcast.
We Come ever do the sexy stuff with Field Crash Survival. So I worked undercover.
What did you learn about the people? You start going undercover and you spend more time with what I would imagine, what I would call like the other side.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So
a whole other culture.
You know, the whole saying, there's honor among thieves, you know, and it's really true. And like, I developed relationships with some of my informants and undercover some of the people that I was quote unquote investigating that were so genuine that they would have like really helped me, really done stuff for me. Whereas like some of the people I worked with wanted to stab me in the fucking back.
Yeah, man. They're trying to, they're you know, they're going for that promotion.
They're vying for promotions or positions.
Or they just don't like
me. Or they
you.
Just don't like me because I'm excelling or whatnot.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget like this investigation in particular, which it was a 6-month long investigation. So pretty long undercover stint, generally speaking. And it wasn't anything crazy. It was a dope case out of a bar that was kind of like a, it's kind of like a punk rock biker bar, but not like a crazy, it wasn't super dangerous. It really wasn't. I wasn't like going undercover with the Mongols or anything like that. Like I acted like a punk rock gutter punk biker, you know, like, and not like an outlaw biker, like, you know, riding an old like fucking panhead, you know?
Right.
And when the team went in to make the arrest and then they brought my informant to the vehicle. It was a female informant, a female target, female informant.
Mm.
And they brought her to the vehicle, and I'm sitting inside that vehicle, and they sit her down next to me in the back seat. Her face was like fucking betrayal.
Right. Yeah.
And bro, it hurt my feelings, dude.
Right.
It hurt my feelings.
If we look up, you know, you know? Betrayal.
Yeah.
It's just like all over.
Yeah. It hurt my feelings, man. It really did. Yeah. Like, I'm like, fuck, man. And then I had to realize like, wait, she's slinging dope.
Yeah, wait a second.
Yeah, well, you know, like she's like, and not like weed either. Like it wasn't weed. Like she's slinging dope out of a bar. Now she was slinging dope for a bigger dealer, which we ended up getting. I used her to get to the bigger fish, which is the whole point. And actually really, I went and like on the stand for her and everything. Like I did everything that I could to make sure she basically didn't even get any prison time.
Mm. I was really hoping you were going to have a story about, you know, like in the, when you picture like when the Joker, when he's like sliding down that like thing of cash,
that's,
you know,
right.
I mean, in the dark. And yeah, I was like, dude, I wanted a big stack of cocaine.
So I was wearing a three piece suit. I had an M16 with an M203 grenade launcher on it, a cigar and a pile of coke. Yeah. And my code name was Al Pacino.
No. Perfect.
No, nothing that cool, unfortunately. But I was buying a lot of coke. I worked for a Secret Service task force for a little bit that was investigating a ring of prostitutes that was following guys to ATMs. They're guys to ATMs to get money out for the prostitute, stealing their PIN code. getting in the car with their pimps, ripping them, and then going back to the ATM.
Yeah.
So I worked that stint picking up hookers on Bourbon Street, which was pretty crazy. Right. You know, that was pretty wild.
This is how you start the, you know, like day, like night one of the job.
Yeah.
What's your introduction?
Night one of that job?
They're like, hey, great, Lappin, get in the car, drive down the road. The hooker, she's going to start talking to you.
So it was all on foot.
Okay.
But I had to dress like a nerd.
Right.
So like, no, seriously. So like, I got my hair cut real nerdy and like, I wore like pleated khakis and like loafers and like a tucked in Izod shirt and like.
Yeah, but how do you hide the ability to bench over 300 pounds?
Oversized clothes. Dude, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised what a haircut and oversized clothes, baggy, nerdy clothes can do for your physique. Because I spent a lot of time throughout like wearing dumb shit, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I'd walk down the street with those big, stupid 42-ounce big ass beers, you know, and walk down the street acting drunk and pick up hookers.
I just picture a Clark Kent version
of
you. I mean, I'm like,
Clark Kent was pretty nerdy.
Like real nerdy dude, you know?
All right, the dude works out, but he's a nerd, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So yeah, hookers don't care, you know?
Right.
So yeah, picked up a lot of hookers, bought a lot of dope. Yeah.
And that's
and there we go. Field Craft Survival, folks.
Yeah, dude. We are talking about the job in the UAE.
Yeah.
This is another interesting thing, even going back to the whole like military FOMO of like just navigating cultures from place to place. Interesting thing about you, again, as you go back from contracting back into law enforcement, and I'm being presumptuous about what the culture in law enforcement looked like. But did you ever feel like that was going back and forth between like big boy rules and like playing mom and dad's game and going back and forth?
Not so much, because there's bullshit anywhere.
There's
bullshit in any organization.
What about the caliber of dudes?
That was definitely different. The caliber of dudes. Now, I will say I had a little bit of a better look when I was going back and forth into law enforcement, especially my last 5 years in law enforcement, right before I moved out here, I was with rock stars. Like, our SWAT team, it's a bigger regional team. It's for the sheriff's office. We're a big parish. We're actually the third largest parish in Louisiana. We had a pretty large team with a big budget, really proactive leadership. And we did really good work. And the dudes on the team were all a little bit older. It was all like early mid 30s to, I was the oldest guy on the team, but like the next youngest guy was 38. So older, more mature dudes. And big boy rules. And I had worked with some studs. Everyone worked out on their own. Everyone trained jujitsu. Everyone shot regularly, competitively. Like, we were all masters of the craft. It was a lifestyle.
Yeah.
But definitely in the early days, the caliber of people, you know, if you're working on a regular patrol shift, the caliber of people are not what you want to be with, you know?
Right.
But I was real fortunate. I didn't really experience that, because I was always going back to like specialized units, if you will, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and the hard part again, like even when in this process did you start feeling like, maybe you were like, we're raised with it even for mentors, where it's like, I think that one thing that people underestimate is like the value of your reputation.
100%. And you know, it's like one of the best things, like your reputation is like a balloon. Takes a lot of really hard breaths to blow that fucker up. And one little prick can ruin it completely. And not that I held a chip on my shoulder, that's not the right term, but like, especially in contracting, because now here I am, quote unquote, just a cop.
Right.
Now just a cop, with a lot of experience, a lot of fights, a lot of foot chases, a lot of car chases, a few shootings, good amount of like pretty intense experience.
Which is great experience. Sorry. And that's what's interesting is
get it out.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're good.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's what's interesting is the fact that there's so much of an emphasis on the experience, which again, I'm not discounting that because it can't be replaced, but just like you point out, the fact that how much of it's a lifestyle and experience is hard to come by. experience, like there's, you have, again, I've come across awesome medics, for example.
Yeah.
Awesome medics, but again, like in their career, they might do like one wild procedure.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Just because of it's that's what it is.
Well, you can't.
So then, you know, the substitute, you know what I mean, or while you're waiting for the experience, if you can't, if you're not in whatever position, or again, you could be in the military waiting to deploy, right, whatever the case is the fact that, like, who are you?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And obviously maintaining a high level of training.
Yeah.
Is the only thing to kind of not offset experience, but bridge the gap of experience.
Right.
And like you said, like experience, you can't pick or choose. Like we can say, hey, we're going to go to this high speed live tissue course this weekend.
Right.
And that's going to give us training. We can't say, hey, we're going to drive through Provo, Utah, and we're going to pull up on this nasty car accident to where you're going to have to crike a dude. Cause that's experience. You can't plan experience.
Yep.
His experience just fucking happens.
Right.
And you're either ready for the game or you're not.
Exactly. And I like, and that, yeah, that's why I'm super selective about who I pick for medical instructing.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's lots of people who, sure, they can teach the content, but how much of it is like, do you have point of injury experience?
Right.
You know what I mean? Dancing with the day that you brought.
Right. Like real day. Like, yeah, hey, yeah, I'm here. Holy shit. Where's, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's tricky, but yeah, I mean, I always try to hold myself to, I would say, maybe an unrealistic standard, especially when I got to contracting. I wanted to make sure that I didn't give any of those dudes any excuse to be like, Lappin's a shitbird, he's the weak link, because I didn't have a selection to fall back on. I didn't have a buds class to throw out. I didn't have a Q course to throw out. I didn't have, you know, anything from the military special operations, you know, units to fall back on. I had, yeah, I'm a cop.
I'm here today.
Yeah. So people would be like, he's fucking squared away or he's a shitbird. So I always made sure I was in the best fucking shape, that I could shoot the best, that I could fight, that I could, you know, like I was studying land nav and I'm doing map reconnaissance studies, and while guys are hanging out and drinking or partying at night, which that's fine. But I didn't have the leeway yet. I was building my reputation, you know? So
yeah, well, I mean, again, I'm like, opportunity cost is always a thing. So what's interesting is, even for those guys that might have the experience with the land nav or with the shooting or whatever the case might be, you know, they're in shape, whatever the case is, even that along that one metric though, because again, you can pick any measuring stick you want to. And so, right, like fighting being an irrelevant measuring stick,
right,
when you're in contracting.
For sure.
And it's, how much time are you spending working on that?
That's right. And you know, as I tell some of the young kids now that are in these mentorship programs that are wanting to go to, you know, SFAS, wanting to go to any of these soft pipelines. And I tell them, you know, they ask me, hey, what should I do? I said, well, one, you need to run a lot, like run a lot. If you're going into Naval Special Warfare, you need to swim a lot too, but get on the mats and train jiu-jitsu. Because when you're with an elite unit, regardless of what your definition of elite is, right? Whether you're with a SWAT team or you're with a special operations unit or you're in a military unit or whatever it is, right? Everyone there is held to a high standard. Everyone there is elite. But when you can beat the fuck out of everybody there because you've put the last 5 years into jiu-jitsu and now you're showing up as a purple belt, it gives you a feather in your cap that no one else there has.
That's not nothing.
And you may be one of the new guys, but you're not going to get treated exactly the same as the other new guys. You know, it's different. And I'm not saying we're puffing our chest. We're not throwing that around saying, oh, I could beat the fuck out of you. You know, it's like it lets those other people know that you have a mental hardness, you know, to persevere.
Yeah. Which again, like that's an interesting, just even perspective of like, you know, going back to some of that FOMO stuff we talked about, you know, you can keep your good paying job and you can stay with your stable family and you can go and do things like train jiu-jitsu and live more of this lifestyle.
That's right.
That is like, hey, we'll gather the skills. You know what I mean, again, the experience is hard to come by, but the more you put yourself, it's like, you know, if you build it, they will come.
That's right.
You know, yeah, and it's, you'll find the opportunities, but if you don't have the skill sets, if you don't have these, like, you don't even, these opportunities just pass you by.
That's right. And, you know, kind of bringing it back to jiu-jitsu is like, you tell me, oh yeah, I'm a blue belt under so-and-so. I immediately know something about you, right? Generally, more often than not, it's pretty accurate. Because we all meet guys that had their blue belt or got a blue belt from a belt factory school or whatnot. But generally speaking, like, you told me, hey, yeah, I'm a blue belt under in Frisco. When, you know, I told you, I know, right? And I know Frisco. I know he's a fucking savage.
Dude, he's just dude, a tank.
And he's a big boy.
He smashes the crap out of him.
But I know something about you immediately because what you needed to do, regardless of military stuff, medic stuff, anything, if I didn't know you about anything else, what you had to do and over the time you had to do it to achieve that blue belt and to earn that blue belt tells me something about you right away.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the best things about jiu-jitsu is like you can meet someone off the street. Oh, yeah, I train under so-and-so. Yeah, I've been, I'm a purple belt under so-and-so. Oh, okay. I know something about you.
And then again, it's like, and like for especially like those of you listening, like even more importantly than that is like, I know something about me.
Right. Yeah.
You know, even for all my different experiences in the military, I mean, because you, again, you can do things like, you know, you can go places and you can do things. But like I had tons of lessons inside of jiu-jitsu that I didn't get anywhere else.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you still learn things about yourself. And again, it's across a different metric. It's not like it was the first hard thing I'd ever done in my whole life, but you know, it was, you know, it's, I would even say, you know, it's super intimate. It can be very uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
And getting over that. And then when you watch people come in and it's like, there's always a hill to climb. You know, there's
no matter how long you've been doing it, no matter what your rank is. And it's funny you say that because, you know, I'm a black belt. I don't think I'm anything special and I'm not. I'm just another person. Just, you and me, we're peers. All my students at my other academy in Louisiana were peers. All my new students here were peers. I don't think I'm anything. I don't even think I'm 45 years old. Like I'm hanging out with all these kids that are like, I'm like, how old are you, bro? 26. I'm like, we're probably close in age. I'm 26. Fuck, I could be your dad, like almost literally.
Greg's getting
like,
a little old. I have to remind him where he's at sometimes.
Yeah, you know? And I'm like, holy shit, I'm 20 years older than you, you know? But to me, like, we're peers. And when I had broken the news to my academy in Louisiana that I was leaving and moving out here to take this position, a lot of people were really upset. And I was like, yeah, you know, I get it. You guys will miss me. The academy's great. I've got six other black belts there, like great black belts, right? You guys are fine. And I was sitting down one night and Casey was like, I brought up something. I was like, man, everyone's really upset I'm leaving. And they're like, you're their Tiago. You know, and Tiago was like, to me, Tiago, when I was a blue belt, was like a god of men. Like,
yeah.
You know, I was like, I'll never be that, you know, and like what he put into me through jiu-jitsu. And I was like, oh, fuck, holy shit. Like, I see myself through my eyes of what I am, which is just a normal person. They see me as something different, you know, and it was when I taught rewilding this last weekend.
Yeah.
It was kind of the same thing. A bunch of guys pulled me aside afterwards. They're like, man, when you shared your stories over the bonfire, you know, that night, that like opened us up big time.
Right.
I was like, you know, why? Well, if a guy like you can open up and be vulnerable with us and say, I'm like, well, a guy like me, what do you mean? You know, like, what do you mean a guy like me? Dude, you're like the man of men. You're like the fucking toughest dude. I'm like, I'm just a dude. I'm just a guy. But they don't see it that way.
I know it was so funny. So then, and that what's funny about that is, so again, so maybe the secret isn't the fact that, oh, well, if this guy is, you know, I mean, maybe the tactic is just like, hey, well, there's actually something to being vulnerable and approachable and being able to just like talk and,
bro.
Like, you know, anyways, like
without being vulnerable, there's no growth.
Exactly.
And just to be on the mat, you're vulnerable. Every day you're on the mat, you're vulnerable, you know?
And again, and with a whole bunch of other peers and with people that's that, you know, like, and so that's again, one of the absolute greatest things of jiu-jitsu is, you know, if you're, you know, it's funny to me how many people go off and they might seek these careers in special forces or law enforcement or whatever the case is, you know, where they think the fun or the action is going to be and to leave, you know, whatever situation they have going. And it's like, well, you maybe, you know, follow your heart. I don't know, but maybe that's something that you need. But in the meantime, you could do things like spend your free time hanging out with the people who are also going to want to spend their time doing the same things that you want to do, which is another, I mean, again, amazing gateway for the
you want to talk about personal growth. Like it happens on the mats, you know, like big time.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's awesome. I'm super stoked to be here. You know, we're already building the tribe. We're already, you know, we're already building the mats getting, I mean, you were at lunch class today, you know, we had like six or eight people on the mat for lunch and like just having fun and people are learning good jiu-jitsu. And like, that's my goal is to keep jiu-jitsu real, not water it down.
Yeah.
Teach people real jiu-jitsu, make them earn every stripe and every belt and be a good ambassador for the sport. And I mean, it's happening. And not just me, it's a team. It's a team thing. It's not just me. Fieldcraft Jiu-Jitsu isn't Greg Lappin. It is all the students and then the other higher ranking guys like Hunter, our purple belt, who's just awesome and a savage. And he's already helping me build the culture. And some of these other black belts from the area that have come down or reached out, or I've reached out to them, and we're growing, you know? So it's super cool. I'm super stoked.
I'm excited, man. You know, just I've only gotten to do the two classes while I was here up in the area. It's like it's a disadvantage to not being able to be here more often, but yeah. I'm excited that what will be fun is I even like that, you know, when I was rolling with Gracie Baja for a while, traveling around, going to different academies. And yeah. It's like it was fun to kind of fall into an academy that at least had a similar, you know, culture, attitude, whatever.
Right.
And I'm excited to have this be like my jiu-jitsu home base.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
sure.
Where, you know, I'll get to move around and travel, but every time I get to come here, man. I'm so stoked that we have the culture here that yeah. It's just gonna like, that's what's gonna feel like in that jiu-jitsu sense is, you know, that's coming right. home. That'd
yeah.
be sweet.
Yeah, no, I'm stoked. And it's growing, it's getting bigger and bigger. So
yeah, yeah.
I can't wait to see where it is in a year from now.
Yeah, well, in a year from now, we'll have to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So
before that, probably, but
yeah.
6 months.
You know.
6 months.
Yep. Hey, well, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks, Greg, for sharing your stories, man, and your expertise. I'm excited that you're on the team.
Yeah, appreciate it.
I love being around and getting to hang out. That seriously is my absolute favorite part of the job is getting to, I love when we all get together. Yeah, I'm excited for next week. We've got Mike Hernandez, Kevin, and Amber coming out. So we're like,
Kevin's bringing his gi. Kevin already told me he's bringing his gi. Yeah.
Right,
Kevin's bringing his gi. Right. I was giving Mikey some shit because his kids are training. I said, why aren't you training, bro?
For sure, dude. So, Mikey, oh man, dude, you better be listening to this and you better get your freaking
bike. I got to be nice to Mikey because he's helping me out with my motor, with my bike. So
well, I don't have to be nice to Mikey.
You don't have to be
he's
nice.
He's not helping
so.
Me out with a bike right now.
There you go. But yeah. So, and next time we talk, we got to talk about how the first time we met was.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, the freaking
the train,
yeah.
The train ride from Salt Lake City.
Dude, we still have so much, man. We didn't even get to talk about you freaking having your pilot's license, all the racing stuff that you were doing. So yeah. We have. There's still, as always, so much.
We'll talk
to
about
do.
Motorized stuff on the next one. Maybe we'll get Mikey here because he's the mobility guy, and we'll talk about my racing stuff at Skip Barber Racing and
yeah.
racing at Yas Marina F1 Circuit, the Dubai Autodrome in McLarens, and flying an airplane, doing a short approach on my first solo flight.
There you go,
because the tower person was brand new.
There we go, man. Well, we have, like I said, we got a whole bunch more planned, and, I'm excited for it. This is going to be nothing but fun, nothing but good things. Yeah. So
awesome, Doc.
Cool. Thanks again, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.
See ya.
Take care.